From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it.
Nobody survives this trajectory, so that's why I think it's important that, you know, I really appreciate you doing this interview.
This is Ben Clark, and the trajectory he's talking about is being an alpinist, climbing mountains in the Himalayas that don't have names and carving routes where nobody has climbed. And he's right. A lot of people die living a life like his, which makes you wonder, why is he doing it? And how do his parents deal with that, thinking their son's next climb could be his last? So that's our first story this week on Outside In. You hear the stories of the daring first ascent, the heroic push to the summit, but when do you hear about mom and dad back home and the very real struggle over which of those two things is more important? I'm going to let producer Megan Tan take it from here.
I think as a kid, I was a terrible athlete.
Why? Why do you say that?
Well, I was really overweight and, you know, just kind of a chubby kid and husky, I think is what you probably would call it.
Ben is originally from Tennessee, and he didn't grow up hiking or rock climbing. As a 12-year-old, less than 5 feet tall, he weighed about 180 pounds, and no one predicted that he would be active. In fact, the doctors told him that instead of playing on his school's basketball team, he should probably be the manager.
Kind of bought in for about 6 months, and then I decided that, you know what, I had a body and I was going to use it anyway.
Ben slimmed down. When he was in college, he hiked the Appalachian Trail with his friends, spent the summer working at Yosemite Park, and by the time he was 19, he decided to climb Mount Rainier, one of the highest peaks in the Pacific Northwest.
Well, I thought it was wonderful that he was outdoors and doing things.
This is Ben's mom, Anne.
I thought that was great. I mean, you know, when you send a young man off to college, there are lots of options they can get into. So I was relieved.
And then he just became a mountain climbing guru. He summited Rainier now more than maybe 28 times.
And this is Jerry, Ben's dad.
Run up and down that thing like a billy goat.
Once I got there, I was hooked. Being in the mountains, that being in that environment, despite all of the adversity, that was home.
In the beginning, Ben's parents didn't really think anything of his new fondness for hiking and climbing. But then Jerry received a phone call from him.
And he called me on his cell phone that night from up on the mountain, and he said he'd been talking to this fella and that he thought he ought to do Everest.
I looked at him one day and I said, Ben, are you really thinking about that? And he said, no, not really. And I thought, oh, yes, you are.
Ann's instincts were right, because when Ben was 21, he told his family he had a goal, to be the second youngest American to summit Mount Everest. But his father, Jerry, was not having it.
Oh, man. Let's just say Jerry was not the least bit encouraging.
If he goes to Everest, he'll get killed. That's just the craziest thing I've ever heard of.
I mean, he just thought it was absolutely, you know, a totally irresponsible thing to do.
They cared, and that's why they were saying it. They weren't saying it because they didn't want to see me accomplish my dreams. They were saying it because they didn't feel it should cost me everything. But, you know, due to a lack of maturity and I would say emotional intelligence at the time, I didn't really hear. I was completely fine with potentially risking my life to achieve a goal like that.
Why? How did you get to that point?
You know, I don't know. I guess that maybe at that age, I guess I didn't have the self-worth that maybe is important. And I was looking for that. I was looking for who I could be. I knew enough about what I could do and what I thought and who I thought I was, but I've just always had a bent to see what I really can accomplish. So yeah, I don't think I had a good idea about risk at all at that time.
Once Ben's parents saw that his goal was manifesting into a plan, something switched in them.
He's going, accept it, get over it, okay.
Then at that point, it shifted in my mind from, do you dissuade him to go, to now you got to support him to the hilt, to make sure that it's successful.
When we finally reached the top, we reached it through really windy, really bad conditions. I was, you know, at the limit of exhaustion like anyone would be up there, and literally just spent 20 minutes there. There was nothing esoteric or triumphant, nothing brilliant about it. It was just essentially, for me, that was the turnaround point on a five-year journey, and I realized that I had gotten there. It was the process was clearly the point and not that 20 minutes.
If Ben's parents thought his expedition to climb Mount Everest was risky, they were in for a big surprise. Because this was just the beginning. Everest had given Ben the alpine bug, which meant that he wanted to climb the highest, most remote, and riskiest peaks in the Himalayas.
Did you have to make sacrifices to put yourself in these situations with the people who were close to you?
The focus that I developed that I think is so important to executing highly consequential life and death situations came with a level of detachment from every relationship around me, and that was mutual. I mean, my parents had to detach.
He said that, you know, the people around him, he felt like had to disconnect themselves from him. Did you feel that way? Like you had
no. No, I just thought he's off on another adventure. I didn't feel like that's the last time I'd see him, no.
But being an alpinist is dangerous. And you don't have to summit Mount Everest for something bad to happen. Risk is always there. Bad storms hit, climbers fall, people get sick. And when you're in the Himalayas, even a minor setback can turn into a life-threatening situation. In 2009, Ben and two of his friends set out for Mount Barunse. Their goal was to climb the mountain on one side in 17 days and then ski down it on the other side.
So you had to climb up this very narrow ridge up this northeast face of this mountain. At 21,600 feet, I looked across the valley. And I looked at the south face of Lhotse, which is the mountain that is connected to Everest. And I watched what must have been about a 3,000-foot tall gust, just a round gust, just hit that face. And it was this beautiful orange alpenglow and just this totally unique to the Himalayas scale everything type of moment. And I just realized living people do not see things like this.
This beautiful moment that Ben is talking about was the calm before the storm.
We found ourselves, up on top of this ridge line, and there was a couple hours of chopping ice and just, you know, staying anchored into the mountain as best we could. It was really blustery, really windy, snow coming down all around us, the sunset, and we hoped we weren't going to get blown off that mountain.
And all of a sudden, the weather just crumped in, and There were blinding snowstorms, and they were sitting in the tent.
And my feet were absolutely frozen, and so I had my feet pressed against John's stomach underneath his shirt, skin to skin, so that they would thaw out and avoid frostbite. While I held John's hands, he threw up in a Ziploc bag in between my legs. And that began the realization that we were now in a serious endeavor.
To make matters worse, as Ben and his friends sat in the tent trying to figure out what they should do, they realized there weren't many escape options.
We had committed to that route in a very bold fashion, meaning that we were willing only to fail up.
What did this mean? They didn't prepare the right kind of equipment to turn around and go back the way they came. And if they did decide to do that, it would be highly dangerous, and they most likely would not make it. Back home, Ben's parents knew what was going on. Jerry, Ben's dad, has always loved tracking the weather. He used to be a pilot. So ever since Everest, once Jerry decided he was going to support Ben's climbing,
He figured he could do it by keeping tabs on the weather.
You know, I know he wanted to be patient and inspire confidence, but one moment he lost it and he's like, I can't believe you would do anything where you couldn't reverse it.
Well, I just tried. I told him, you said, you got to get down. You know, there's not an option. You got to get down. You got to get this. You got to find the best weather window we can find. And then you got to act. You can't sit there and die in that tent.
I think I was the last one to fall asleep around daybreak. And, you know, just having this this old Grateful Dead song actually rolling around in my head, I Bid You Good Night. And I just remember thinking that song and just singing it over and over my head thousands of times that night.
Lay down, my dear brothers, lay down and take your rest. I want you to lay you here upon your Savior's breast.
You just, you feel so helpless because you can't do anything. And you don't know what he can do to be any better off. But as I say, I do a lot of praying.
What do you say when you pray?
Ask that he be safe, that he get down safely. Or whatever happens, that I have the strength to handle it. I think our prayers are answered, sometimes not the way we want them to be. So I feel like however he came back, if he's injured, if he's in a hospital the rest of his life, if he's missing a limb, you know, whatever happens, give me the strength and the resources to deal with it and not be resentful.
I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best. And I bid you good night, good night, good night.
We got back down to the glacier on day 10. And, you know, everyone in that whole valley thought we were dead.
You're hearing Ben's voice, so it's needless to say that they survived intact. But were you ever just like, I just want you to stop this?
Yeah, we talked about that, but at that point in his life, he wasn't ready to stop.
You'd think that being trapped in a tent for 5 days on the side of a mountain with a 20,000-foot drop and then ice climbing down backwards, knowing that you could die, would change something inside of Ben. But it didn't. That same year, Ben lost 4 friends in 4 different climbing accidents.
You know, these were the best of the best, and they didn't come back. So this luck isn't going to hold out forever. There aren't many old climbers.
One of those friends was Rob. He had been skiing down a mountain in Alaska when an avalanche buried him. Ben was there and was shocked because the series of events were unpredictable and he had lost a hero of his. But it wasn't until Ben met Rob's mother did he understand how the weight of Rob's actions and his actions affected the people who were closest to him.
She showed up to meet and talk with his friends and to have this sort of this memorial, this wake. And she hadn't seen him, I think, in 10 years. And to see somebody who was learning everything about their child in reverse order, starting from the moment that the first time they had seen each other in 10 years being in his coffin in Manhattan at a morgue, and just trying to figure out how he arrived at that point, who he had become, what he was. I stood there and just immediately all these tears just came right to the forefront, and it was like, you know, all these, you know, these amazing summits and all these thousands of ski turns and these billions of stars we were staring at every night in these remote places. All that was just had to go. I'm essentially married to the mountains and I love them. But, you know, something has got to change. I've got to stop loving and caring so much about this.
And something did change. The same year that his friend passed away, Ben became a father and made the decision to retire after spending 10 years in the Himalayas. But you don't have any regrets, right?
No, I don't. I understand that Charlie, my son, dictates everything in my life, and I'm here for him and my family. I mean, all I want is to be a part of that. That is so much more important to me. Feeling loved, giving what love I have to give to other people, being emotionally available, all these things that I blocked out are far more important than the next mountain I might top out. I've lived a lifetime already. It's cool.
If you were to want to take up mountaineering in the same capacity that you did, what would you do, you think?
You know, and Charlie has the creativity that I have. You know, if we find that he has this need for focus and that he is drawn to the environments that I was drawn to, you know, the curiosity takes him to those places. As much as I will probably eat my own words admitting it, it's hypocritical of me to disagree with it on any front, you know. But just like my own parents, I will be awake at night, I'm sure, worrying just as much as anybody because I love him. His love and his being in this world awakened me in a way that nothing else ever was going to.
So this feels like a perfect place to end this story, right? Ben retires, starts raising a child, everything comes full circle. But of course, you've heard the phrase, a parent's job is never done. Well, that's how Ann and Jerry feel.
You know, my attitude is, well, what's he going to do now? And that's when he got into this ultra running and doing these, you know, Nolan's 14 and stuff.
Nolan's 14, by the way, is an ultramarathon where runners try to summit 14 separate 14,000-foot mountains in Colorado in less than 60 hours. So Ben may have climbed down from the Himalayas, but let's just say he's not out of the woods.
So you haven't really exhaled as a parent yet?
No, we never will.
And now we strategically pivot from metaphorical family ties to actual literal ties, like ropes. Ropes in the ocean, an ocean full of whales.
They're like a freight train, and so trying to slow down the freight train is hard. Trying to disentangle the freight train while it's still moving is really difficult.
How far will our rhetorical gymnastics take us from the slopes of the Himalayas? Only one way to find out, coming up on Outside In. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. A little while ago, here in New Hampshire, this crazy thing happened.
I mean, so there's probably like 100 people here.
Probably a little bit more.
Yeah.
We can't see all the people over the bluff.
Right.
This was me and Outside In producer Molly Donahue down on New Hampshire's seacoast, where there was a situation that just smelled really bad.
Oh, yeah. Now it's really powering up. Yeah, it definitely gets your gag reflex going.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's going on here is last week, a humpback whale that had somehow died out at sea, and as of now, they don't know what killed her, had washed up on shore here in New Hampshire.
With 6 or 8 inches of blubber and no cooling system on board, it essentially was an oven for a few days, and a lot of the tissue is quite deteriorated.
That's Tony LaCasse with the New England Aquarium, who was in charge of doing the whale autopsy, also known as a necropsy. The smell that he's talking about, rather matter-of-factly, is like nothing I've ever experienced. You could easily smell the whale from more than 100 yards away, and when you got close, if there wasn't a breeze, it was quickly enough to make you gag. But the science-y types, a couple of times while we were watching, had to actually climb on top of this carcass and straddle it as they cut pieces away. And they don't even look like they're batting an eye.
Oh, well, these are seasoned responders.
That's Wendy Lull, president of the Seacoast Science Center, who was coordinating the entire whale removal effort.
So right now I've got a lot of Vicks Vapor Rub in my nose, which is
a good trick
for it. Many of them have become a little bit immune, or they also know how to get out of the wind if they're going to. Right now the wind is kind of in the favor of the responders, although we've noticed that the provision tent is downwind of the carcass, but we'll be fine.
So imagine the scene here. There's this whale carcass, 45 feet long, 40 tons of stinking, rotting meat. It's been on the beach in the hot summer sun for 2 days. The scientists are climbing all over it and cutting it into pieces because, you know, 40 tons of whale can't just be picked up with a tractor. And despite that gory process, there are still hundreds of people gathered to watch. And that's a small crowd. At this point, the whale gazers had begun to move on.
Last night, you know, when there were thousands of people literally coming to ride. That is not an exaggeration. There were thousands of people. I'm from New Hampshire originally, and I was asking people where they were coming from. And they were coming from 25, 30, 40 miles away because it was an opportunity for them to show their children something that they thought was important.
Whales, even a dead whale, rotting, stinking, cut into bits on a beach, whales capture something in our imagination. They're gigantic, they're intelligent, they're mysterious, they're beautiful. And because all of that, they were one of the original flagship species. The anti-whaling movement is more than 100 years old. And in the 70s, Save the Whales was all over bumper stickers and pins and t-shirts. And then in the 80s, commercial whaling, in most countries at least, came to an end. A lot of species are recovering. For instance, most populations of humpbacks, those iconic acrobats of the whale world, were taken off the endangered species list this year. But then there's the North Atlantic right whale, a whale that got its name because in the whaling era it was known as the right whale to kill. They were slow swimmers with lots of blubber, so they floated after they'd been harpooned. The right whale hasn't bounced back. There are less than 500 of them in the Atlantic coast of the United States today. And over in Europe, they're called functionally extinct. And one of the things that's killing these whales, it's not harpoons and hunters, it's ropes. Millions of ropes.
Now you have to visualize yourself as this massive whale, right? This gargantuan animal trying to swim through this tangled web of ropes. You know, what was that game? Operation, where you try to pull out the bone without hitting the edge, and the red nose would go, meh.
Okay, whales sometimes get tangled up in fishing gear, and by sometimes, I mean a lot. By looking at their scars, scientists have estimated that 83% of right whales get tangled up in ropes. But back in the 90s, whale scientists started to notice this trend. While roughly the same number of whales were getting tangled, those entanglements were getting worse.
Meaning that it could compromise their ability to feed or swim, and it's going to eventually lead to their death.
Amy Knowlton, a scientist with the New England Aquarium, got to work trying to track down what was driving this trend. Why were whales getting more seriously tangled up?
And we have been able to link that to a change in rope manufacturing that occurred in the mid-1990s.
Rope manufacturers had made a much stronger rope.
So it's a blend of two different types of plastics that together make a stronger fiber.
All of a sudden, whales are hitting ropes just like before, but they're not breaking free like they were. They hit the rope, they thrash around, and they get all wrapped up in it. So what to do about this? For a bit of the answer to this question, I have a story. And since I felt like I needed an audience for this story, I brought producers Jimmy Gutierrez and Logan Shannon into the studio. Okay, can you hear me?
Yep.
I can hear you.
You can hear me. I can hear you guys. Okay, so this story starts with a guy who lives out on Cape Cod.
I'm Scott Landry with the Marine Animal Entanglement Response Team here at the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown.
And it involves a right whale named Wart.
Wart.
Whales often get nicknames for their physical characteristics. So Wart had a big wart.
She showed up in early spring in 2008 with rope stuck in her mouth.
And that generally, that's like, that's pretty bad. That's not a great way to be.
As the rope drags through the water, it's creating a force. Mm. And that force is slowly sawing into the whale's skull.
It causes horrible lacerations, infections. If it catches on a whale's flipper, it can permanently deform that flipper. And like, as a way to die, it's particularly gruesome. It can take like up to 6 months for an entangled whale to pass away. And so when this happens, what you do is you call Scott Landry. He's the guy you call. And what he does is he has this team of five dudes, and they saddle up in a boat, and they head out to cut the whale free. But in this case, with Wart, they were just sort of like, you know, it's not so bad.
Lots of right whales have gone through this before.
Unless things get worse, we're just going to leave it alone. Next year.
In 2009... she showed up again in Cape Cod Bay with the rope still stuck in her mouth. But somehow she had worked it out through the other side of her mouth, so it was coming out of both sides of her mouth, the same piece of rope.
What?
How she did that, I don't know.
They're like, ugh, damn it, Wart. So they're like, all right, now, you know, this is getting a little more serious. We're going to help her out.
Just real quickly, how big is Wart? Like, how big is a right whale?
So right whales can be like 40 feet long, you know, 25 tons. I mean, they're big. They're like, you know, they're underwater freight trains.
Like in comparison to this little rubber dinghy that they're in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So pretty rarely people have been killed. But the people who do get killed doing this work, it's because they get crushed. So what they do normally with whales is they try to slow them down. So if it's trailing a bunch of ropes, they'll attach other ropes to that rope with other buoys on it. And eventually the whale's just like, oh my God, this is a lot of work. I'm just going to stop swimming. And that works really well on humpback whales, but not on right whales.
There's nothing that's enough to stop a right whale.
Humpback whales actually eat fish, and so they're kind of like sprinters. They'll see a bunch of fish, and they'll swim after them really quickly and like open their mouth and close it. Right whales are filter feeders.
So they're designed to swim through the water with their mouths open for hour after hour after hour. And this takes an enormous amount of strength to do. They're like a freight train. And so trying to slow down the freight train is hard. Trying to disentangle the freight train while it's still moving is really difficult.
And not only that, they just don't like people. So you get anywhere close to them, and they're just like, peace, and they head out. So with this whale, where she's got the rope coming out of two sides of her mouth, they can't slow her down. So they have these like sort of like, they call it a cutting grapple.
What?
It's basically like a ball of knives. And they throw it into the rope and they just like cut it. They pull it back through and it cuts part of it.
And it doesn't hurt the whale.
Okay, so they do their best to avoid the whale, but also just like think of how big a whale is compared to how big a kitchen knife is. So even if they do cut her, it's basically just like a paper cut.
All right. Well, I mean, a paper cut's not that bad.
Right. So Scott and their team, they get as close as they can to Wart. They cut the rope, and remember, this is not like a super precise tool, so there is still some rope left in her mouth, but it's not as heavy, so they're hoping that it'll do a little less damage, and she swims off. Year three comes around.
That rope that was through her mouth had become unbraided, and a long length of that braid had wrapped around her upper jaw and was starting to dig into her upper jaw.
This is really bad. A right whale has these massive lower jaws, but it's really skinny on top. It's like the thinnest part of her body. And this rope could really easily cut right down to the bone and maybe kill her.
And so now we're in a very serious situation with this individual whale. It had gone from not life-threatening at all to absolutely the worst entanglement possible.
They're like, all right, time to get serious about Wart. But here's the problem. Like, right whales hate people.
Rightfully so, it seems like.
Yeah. Throw my ball of knives at you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I put this rope out to catch some other fish and then it entangled you in it. Of course they hate people.
So what they do is they use a two-team approach to tracking down the whale.
Aerial survey planes that were looking for right whales would come across her.
The pilots let him know that they found Wart, and he and his team jump in their boat, and they drive out to where the pilot said the whale was.
They would circle the whale until we got there.
But as soon as Scott would get there, Wart would dive under the water. And if the sea was all choppy, they would lose track of her, even with the spotting planes.
You think, well, okay, she was heading west the last time I saw her. Let's head west and hope that we intersect her when she comes back up from a dive. And lo and behold, we turn back and look, and she had gone east.
So she would, like, juke them every time. But then finally comes the day.
Flat calm conditions, beautiful conditions.
Tells them where to go. They drive out. She dives.
Finally, the plane said, look, she's coming up for air.
And they're positioning the boat. So they're like 45 feet maybe away from where she's going to come up. She pops up and they've got their secret weapon ready.
Oh.
Which is a crossbow. They had found an arrow that could cut rope. And they'd been practicing for weeks.
But they're on a boat.
In the ocean.
In the ocean.
Yeah.
We shot the arrow, and she dove very quickly. It all happened in about 1.5 or 2 seconds. We all looked at each other. We had no idea really what had happened. It all was just too fast for the human eye to see.
And they wait. And a couple minutes later,
she resurfaced for air and the rope was gone.
Amazing.
It was very lucky. And also a lot of practice.
And who made the shot?
We never say that.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah,
that's so funny.
Yeah. We work as a team.
Yeah.
So if you think about it, the person who got the boat in the right position was working just as hard as the person using the crossbow.
There's no lead singer of this band.
No, there absolutely isn't. And we had finally ended a 3-year-long entanglement.
They're like a SEAL team.
They're like a rope-cutting Navy SEAL team.
All for one.
And I will say, I was able to verify that Scott Landry was, in fact, the one who shot the arrow. He's just a very modest guy. This is like a really nice story. It's got a challenge. It's got tension. It's got a hero. It's got a beginning, a middle, and an end.
I like it, but it stresses me out. This is just one story about one whale. And I just imagine there are so many whales that are suffering the same sort of fate of having these ropes and hoping against hope that maybe a team will be able to help them.
So that's very astute. Because, in fact, it's actually a low percentage of whales that we even see that have the ropes in their mouths. Because remember, 80-something percent of whales get tangled, and each year we're only cutting, like, maybe a dozen of them free. Which is why Tim Werner, who's a scientist at the New England Aquarium, hates this story.
Oh, isn't that nice? We went out and freed that rope off that animal, and we're saving whales. Hip, hip, hooray for us.
It's not quite fair to say he hates this story. He hates that this is the story that we hear all the time. If you ever hear about whales in the news, it's usually because one of them just got cut free from some ropes, and you almost never hear about the hundreds that never do. And New England is like ground zero for this problem. I mean, if you think about it, just in the state of Maine, depending on the year, there's somewhere between 4,000 and 6,000 commercial lobstermen. And each of them has a maximum of 800 traps. So we're talking like literally millions of lobster pots on the Maine coast, millions of ropes that whales have to avoid. And we're not even talking about mooring buoys, eel pot buoys, these new offshore mussel farms.
Now you have to visualize yourself as this massive whale, right? This gargantuan animal, like trying to swim through this like tangled web of ropes, you know. It's, what was that game? Operation, where you try to get the, you try to pull out the bone without hitting the edge, and the red nose would go, meh.
I actually kind of think it's more like Mission Impossible with like the lasers.
Yeah.
And the spies trying to jump through the lasers. Except you're like an underwater freight train instead.
You're not Catherine Zeta-Jones or something.
So here's why I brought you guys in. I think we can figure this out. How do we solve this problem? How do we keep whales from getting tangled up in ropes?
Robots.
Maybe some whale helmets?
Oh, yeah, outfit them with little helmets that are like covered in knives.
Oh.
I will say no one has suggested that yet. You guys are innovators.
Sometimes you have to think big to think, you know, to think small.
All right, I'm just going to play you guys this sound.
Is that sonar?
That is the sound of a pinger. Pingers are used to keep certain kinds of whales that are very sensitive to sound away from fishing nets. So one idea is maybe we could make something that's louder that could do the same thing for whales that aren't super sensitive to sound, like humpback whales and right whales.
I don't know. That does not seem like a good idea.
Right. Turns out this idea is really hard to figure out. You need a sound loud enough to startle an underwater freight train, but not so loud that you freak out the dolphins and the porpoises that use echolocation. And even if you, in fact, found that sound, what would you do? I mean, would you, like, put one on every rope in the entire Gulf of Maine?
Yeah, and you have nowhere. I feel like they'd get there, they'd hear all these noises, they have no idea which direction to go.
Okay, some other ideas from scientists. They talked about changing the colors of the ropes so that whales could see them more easily, which led the researchers to realize that they didn't even know how whales really see. There was this really deeply insane science from UNH where they were like, well, maybe if we kept the ropes really stiff so there's a lot of tension in them, then that they would be less likely, maybe they just sort of like bounce off the ropes instead of getting wrapped up
or get decapitated.
yes helmets.
Yeah, so stiff ropes were a terrible idea. And then there was, oh, so here's one of my favorites. This is from Australia, which, you know what that means. Australian accents.
Can you just introduce yourself?
Scott Wesley from, I'm a lobster fisherman in New South Wales, Australia.
Oh, riser blades.
Scott Wesley. He fishes in an area where there were already a bunch of challenges that had nothing to do with whales. For one, they've got this really famous current that rips down the coast.
And anyone that's got a child and watched the movie Finding Nemo would see that where the turtles come zooming down in the jet stream. We have that coming past our front doors.
And also, they have a problem with theft.
So they just pulled up your traps and went to another jurisdiction and sold your lobsters?
Correct.
How much did it cost you?
Probably $100,000 over 2 months.
Whoa. Damn. So to fix this, Scott went out looking for something that would make it so his buoys wouldn't be floating at the surface all by themselves where they could attract thieves. So this is how this works. It's kind of like the same technology that you use to open your car door. They take the rope and the buoy that they use to haul up the trap from the bottom of the ocean, and they pack all of that into a bag, and they sink it to the bottom where it's attached to the trap. And attached to the bag is this little latch. The latch is connected to a device, so they drive up with the boat, they hit a button, the device releases the latch, and the buoy and the rope float to the surface, and they're only in the water column for like a minute at a time.
Clever.
This is my favorite thing so far.
Clever.
Seems awesome. Probably, though, would never work in New England.
Our lobsters are gregarious, so getting the first couple in's the hard bit, and then from there on, they want to be with all their friends.
And our lobsters hate each other.
And your lobsters hate each other. That's exactly right.
The problem with this method is that Australian lobster fishermen will put down one trap and get like 200 lobsters in there. And a New England lobster fisherman will put out like 200 traps in a day and get like one lobster each. This system costs around $1,800 per trap. So if you're doing 20 traps with 200 lobsters each one might be worth a few $1,000s, and it's not that big of a deal. But if you're doing 200 traps a day, that cost starts to get really real.
Can I just interrupt and say, what's up with their traps? Why are they so much better than New England traps?
Because their lobsters are gregarious.
What does that mean?
Well, I think he meant gregarious, like they like each other.
They want to party together.
Is there like lobster Prozac that we could give these lobsters so that they would be more friendly to each other?
Chill them out a little bit. Get them in a nice big trap. So anyway, Scott's point is that we have very different fisheries.
So it's chalk and cheese that way.
Chalk and cheese.
Chalk and cheese.
I'm using that forever. Chalk and cheese. It's chalk and cheese.
All right. Last call. Last call for ideas for how to stop whales from getting tangled up in ropes.
I don't know. It seems like you'd want to look at maybe changing the rope somehow.
Aha. Now you're on the right track. Remember how stronger ropes were making the entanglements worse?
Yeah.
Now just hold that in your brain for a second. Let's go to Cape Cod Bay. This is a place where right whales spend some time every year, and it's a place where a lot of fishing happens. So to try to keep right whales alive, federal fishing regulators said, maybe if we don't put out any traps or nets in February, March, and April, fewer whales will get tangled in ropes. Needless to say, the fishermen were not really happy about this.
So you can be upset about what the law is and kick the dirt and throw your hat in the ground, but that gets you nowhere other than having dirty shoes and a hat that has dirt on it.
But because these fishermen basically have lost a couple months of the year worth of fishing, they're really motivated to find a solution.
At some point, you have to try and coexist.
So this idea, we're going to hear about it from a fisherman in Cape Cod Bay named
John Havlin from Green Harbor, Massachusetts.
And he's like, fishermen aren't going to want to replace all their ropes.
What the commercial fishermen try to think about is how to use their existing equipment.
But what we could do is design something that would make our ropes break away more easily so that whales don't get so badly tangled. So imagine like a Chinese finger trap. Now imagine that your fingers in that trap are two pieces of rope that you're trying to connect.
And so if it's pulling against it, it's going to stay together. But
if something were to pull really hard, it would break that finger trap.
So it's like a coupler. It's like a little piece of coupling that you put on there.
Pretty clever, though.
It's very clever. I mean, it was so simple, it plumb evaded me.
That's basically what John Havlin is promoting. Fun trivia. Bitter end, like to the bitter end.
That's where it comes from.
That's a nautical term. The bitter end is all the way out at the end of a rope.
Wealth of information.
So your fingers are the two bitter ends of two pieces of rope. You stick them in this sleeve. And then you've taken your existing rope and made it so it's got like a weak link in it.
Ah.
So that's one idea. And it's pretty promising. The New England Aquarium just got $180,000 from the state of Massachusetts to help to try it out. Downsides? Have you ever heard of ghost fishing?
Are you fishing for ghosts?
Ghost fishing is when a rope breaks, you lose some gear, and it just stays down there fishing on its own forever.
Oh.
So imagine, for example, you've just got this huge net full of fish that can't get out, and they die, and as they rot away, more fish are still getting caught in the net, and that just goes on forever and ever.
It's a terrible visual.
So ghost fishing is bad, but also even with the finger trap design, some whales were still going to wind up getting caught in the ropes.
Yeah, so, I mean, out of everything that you kind of thrown out there, it doesn't seem like we have this figured out really at all.
Yeah. And there was actually this kind of crazy moment when I was talking to Tim Werner, who's one of those scientists with the New England Aquarium, and I asked him if he actually does think it's possible for, you know, vertical ropes in the water to coexist with whales. And he just started listing off all of these reasons why this problem is probably going to get more serious. Like, there are these offshore mussel farms that are getting more popular. Soon, there are probably going to be floating wind turbines out in the ocean that have to be moored to the seafloor somehow.
Can I make an observation?
Sure.
I asked you if this is a solvable problem, and you led off with stories about how the problem is going to get even more severe in the years to come.
Right. So how about that logic? Yeah, what I meant by that was
I think what he meant is that if this problem gets worse, then there's going to be even more pressure to solve it. And if there's anything that this past week has taught me, I mean, we went to a beach this week where there were thousands of people coming to see the stinky, half-dissected carcass of a humpback whale. I mean, this is like the definition of a flagship species. They were on bumper stickers. They were on T-shirts. Everybody loves whales. Everyone thinks they're amazing. And they'll shell out big bucks to go and sit on the cold, windy deck of a whale-watching ship in the North Atlantic just on the chance that they'll catch a glimpse of one. We've got entire networks of guys up and down the East Coast who are trained to jump into boats and go and shoot ropes off of these animals with rope-cutting crossbows. I'm pretty sure that this is a species that when push comes to shove, people are going to be willing to pull out all the stops to protect them. And they're just not quite sure how yet.
But at least they're trying? I mean, that's sort of...
A for effort.
A for effort? I mean, at least we're not ignoring the problem.
So So far, this has been a pretty rough year for whales. The preliminary numbers are that 43 of them got entangled on their way up the East Coast, and 3 died. That includes 2 right whales, which remain on the list of endangered species. Coming up, while some questions about the outdoors are very serious, some aren't.
Here's my question. Why did it take my dog so long to figure out exactly where it is that he wants to go to the bathroom?
There's no question about the outdoors I'll turn my nose up to. That's up next on Outside In. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In. I'm Sam Evans-Brown, and I'm here joined in the studio by senior producer Taylor Quimby.
Hey.
And executive producer Maureen McMurray.
Hello.
And so why are you guys here?
Well, we're here because it is our regular segment, Ask Sam, where we invite listeners to ask you questions about the natural world, things they're curious about. We have a hotline for it, and people call in and leave us messages, and then Taylor and I get those messages and bombard you with questions.
And there's a theme song.
Yes.
Why do geese make V's? Does a bumblebee sneeze? Can a person eat trees? Can a polar bear freeze? Is a kidney stone kind of like a pearl in a clam?
Well, I don't know. Ask Sam.
So what do we got?
Well, let's find out. Let's go to our call. Here it is.
Saved message. Time, 6:17 p.m.
Hey, Sam. It's Rebecca from Hopkinton, New Hampshire. Also from across the aisle from you at work. You know, I'm the digital director here at NHPR. Here's my question. Why did it take my dog so long to figure out exactly where it is that he wants to go to the bathroom? Number one. Number two, it doesn't matter. It's a lot of pickiness going on leash, off leash, on walks on the road, in the woods, running free. It doesn't matter. Location seems to be incredibly important, and I want to know why. Please answer my question. Bye-bye.
Wow. Okay, so this is the Ask Sam episode where we reveal the fact that Ask Sam is actually a total sham, and it's just to ask other people, because I have no idea.
I actually know some of the reasons for this. One, and this is probably the most relatable thing, it's hard to go to the bathroom. And if you're outside, and you're going to find a comfortable spot. Do you ever go into somebody's house where they've got a weird toilet and it's dirty and like it you have trouble summoning
the urge?
Maureen is looking at me like, this has never happened.
I've gone to someone's house and it's that filthy.
I just mean it's different.
The space is uncomfortable for, yeah.
I've gone on vacations where like I stopped using the bathroom, I stopped having number two for like a couple days because I feel like my body was just like, no, you're in a weird new place, don't do it.
Oh my God.
Maybe I'm speculating here.
Do you have any link between that experience that you had and our dog's experience?
To some degree. So I just moved to a new apartment and my dog has been not going to the bathroom as easily. One of the reasons that I've actually heard is that because dogs, like anybody, can be distracted. So, you know, I'm in a new neighborhood that has a lot of other pets and a lot of other pet owners. And so if it starts to go to the bathroom and then it sees like a squirrel on a tree or another dog, then often it'll just stop what it was about to do and it'll, you know, pull at the leash and want to yap at a squirrel. I also have heard that some dogs know that they're being taken out to use the bathroom, but they want to be outside. So maybe they're waiting because they just want to spend time outside, and they know that as soon as they go to the bathroom, their owner is going to take them back in.
Rebecca's dog really likes the natural world and using it. Doesn't want to go back in.
You know, this wasn't the definition of using the natural world that we thought of when we came up with that tagline.
No.
All right. Let's, Sam, do the thing that you do where you call people.
Ask Sam to call someone.
I'll be back. Okay, I'm back. That actually was really, really easy.
Oh, good.
So maybe we should just go get Rebecca?
Yeah, let's get her.
All right, hold on. Okay.
Hello, hello.
Hey, Rebecca.
Hey,
Hey, Sam.
So we're back. We've brought Rebecca Lavoie into the studio here instead of arbitrarily making her call into a random phone line. So, Rebecca, here's what I've got for you. I found a guy named Brian Hare, who's the founder of Duke University's Canine Cognition Center.
Nice.
He's also the founder of something called Dognition. Dognition.com.
All right.
Which I struggled to understand, but it sounds like it's some kind of mix between Lumosity for dogs and kind of like a citizen science project. All right. So anyway, here's the story. This comes straight from Dr. Hare.
The reason it's such a process is because dogs evolve from wolves, of course. And just like wolves, they leave a lot of information in their urine and in their feces about who's been there, when they've been there, what is their reproductive status, what they've been eating, et cetera. And so, you know, it's not, as people say often, it's like the dog's reading the newspaper to smell what others have left. And then they are creating content, as we are right now, Sam, by going to the bathroom in special places. And just like you, as a media person, you want to put your product, your content, somewhere where people will see it, where people will hear it and read it. And the reason that dogs, for instance, like to defecate or urinate on things that are high is because that's going to be easier for someone else's sniffer to run into.
So they're going for page views.
Right, they're looking for readership.
So what do you think about that? Does that check out for your experience?
Yeah, so basically what he's saying is it's like the dog, just like we spend a lot of time trying to compose the perfect Instagram photo to show where we've been, what we're eating, what we're up to try to appeal to as many people as possible, like that's what the dog's doing. It's like Poopstagram.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Wow.
And so there are a couple things, like we had sort of bantered this about, you know, distraction Taylor had mentioned.
Yeah.
That is a real thing. If you're in a distracting environment for a dog, that slows them down big time.
Yeah.
Other dogs are definitely the worst. My least favorite thing is when you've been on a walk, you've been waiting for the moment, and it clearly it's like they're getting into position.
That little
and then
hunch.
The head just like looks up suddenly and they see another dog across the street.
Don't you get so mad
stops.
At the person with that dog? Don't you ever get like angry? Like, why did you have to bring your dog out at this moment?
You know, I my anger is sort of undirected. I just get angry in general.
Does anxiety have anything to do with it? I think, Taylor, you said something about like almost performance anxiety. Maybe that's not the right way to say it.
No, but I think that's the right way to say it. Sometimes that happens. Something that has to do with, you know, performance anxiety. It's harder or easier depending on what they're eating, yes or no.
Yeah, well, and they also have a big, there's a lot to do with preference. So it's like at 4.5 months old, a lot of dogs develop their preference for where they like to poop. And
yep.
It's like the surfaces they like to poop on and like the surroundings they like to be in. So once those preferences are set, if they're not in that space, they have a really hard time.
It's a real problem when you have a baby dog and there's snow on the ground and then suddenly there isn't. They do not know what to do.
What happens on the beach?
You're not allowed to have your dog poop on the beach, Maureen. What kind of beach do you go to?
The worst beach ever.
Poop Island.
Wait. What about the, what was the thing we were talking about? Like magnetic poles?
Yeah. Okay. So here's the other thing that you perhaps have not considered. Rebecca, have you ever paid attention to what direction your dog points himself when he goes?
I have, only because I heard about it on NPR about, I want to say like a year ago, there was like a report that dogs like to face north when they go to the bathroom. So I'm not going to lie. I have started paying attention to that.
So you're out there with your compass as he goes?
Well, I know which way is north because that's the side that the moss grows on the trees, right, Sam?
Ooh, how about that?
Yeah.
You've been paying
attention.
Nature girl. So anyway, here's just another Brian clip.
If you think about your dog pooping, they often seem to kind of spin around a little bit. It's not just finding the right spot, but then once they find it, they kind of take forever. There you are. It's freezing cold outside.
Yeah,
you know, I remember I had my dog in Germany and it was freezing winter and it's like, would you just go already? And he's found the place. It's high up. You can see there's sort of urine spots in the snow. So I know there's good chance he's going to go here. And then he's spinning around and around and around. Finally, he can kind of, you know, mosey in there and do his business. And it seems that this study found a relationship between dogs orienting towards magnetic north when they defecate, which, I mean, who would have thought that?
Yeah. And so we don't know why exactly. It's just they're sensitive to magnetism somehow, and that's, right. That's how they like it.
Why they would do that, nobody knows.
Well, that could come in handy, I guess, if you're lost.
Is it different in Australia?
Though fun caveat from that study, which I like looked up in preparation for this, they only do that when the magnetosphere is relatively calm. So you can tell when there's like a magnetic storm going because your dog's like on an east-west axis.
Wow. Stuart, who knew? Who knew?
So do you feel like your question's been answered?
I feel like it was answered thoroughly, informatively, and, you know, I actually am kind of, like, proud of my little social media poopstagramming dog right now. He's got, like, some social media poop savvy.
Well, you don't know how many followers he has.
If you have a question about the natural world that you've been dying to ask, call the Ask Sam hotline. The number is 603-223-2448.
Hey, Sam, just wondering what your thoughts are on those weird running shoes, the ones that, like, go between your toes and look like gloves, but on your feet.
Why can't we just kill all the mosquitoes? I'm wondering if it's better to take a peanut butter and jelly sandwich on a hike or a cheese sandwich.
Again, 603-223-2448. And seriously, no question is too silly. Outside In was produced this week by me, Sam Evans-Brown, Megan Tan, Taylor Quimby, Maureen McMurray, Logan Shannon, Molly Donahue, and Jimmy Gutierrez. That's it for our fall season of shows. But remember, we are a podcast as well as a broadcast, and you can hear from us every 2 weeks if that's what strikes your fancy. So take out whatever device you've got in your pocket right now and subscribe. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, NPR One, or really however you listen to podcasts. We had original music composed this episode by Uncanny Valleys, and our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. I'm Sam Evans-Brown, and Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. See you next time.